Okay. Mr. Hunt, can we start by getting your full name?
Well, my name is Herman Hunt, H-U-N-T. I was born in Indiana, and I lived out here since I was about 18 months old.
And what year were you born? What year were you born?
I was born in 1901. Yeah, March the 10th.
Okay.
And I've lived here practically ever since. That is, since bought out here from 1902 when I was brought out here. But I've lived here almost continuously ever since, you know. Mm-hmm. I went on the my first interest in the railroad, though, dates back to when I was about 5 years old. My mother had taken my brother and myself back to her parental home in Pendleton, which is a suburb of Indianapolis. And there was a road crossing, grade crossing there, about six blocks from her house, where in those days the New York Central trains, the Big Four, en route to St. Louis from Cleveland, they crossed the street there. Very few trains in those days stopped at Pendleton. They were all en route to Indianapolis, of course, or from Indianapolis. But I was fascinated. I was only five, and I was fascinated by the way those huge locomotives, New York Central, would roar over that crossing, pulling these passenger trains, you know. And I could sit there and watch them for the hour, but usually they traced me from my grandmother's house, and I got a spanking all the way home, people going down there to watch those trains. So that's really where my interest started when I was 5 years old. But it wasn't until 1919, some years later, that I really got to start it on the railroad. I got a job in the Tacoma Roundhouse, and I liked it fine. And luckily, I won the approval of the night foreman, Mr. Charlie Miller, and he favored me with sending me out as a fireman long before some guys would have been sent out. So I not only got a lot of practice on switching, but on the road jobs too, because in those days, the fugitive sound division ended at Tacoma from Auburn and Seattle. And a lot of the crews on the eastern trains, particularly in the wintertime, when they were late, their rest wouldn't be up. You see, they have to allow them so much rest after a trip. And the Puget Sound then, there'd be none available with the rest up. So then Miller would look around his staff of people in the roundhouse there to fire these extra trains that had to go, usually just to Auburn, but sometimes to Seattle and back, you see. And so I was very fortunate in that I did have that opportunity to learn the tricks of firing a road engine long before I should have, you see. And I've always been grateful for that, because later on it was very helpful. I knew what I could do and couldn't or shouldn't do with a steam fire, you know. So that was very much of an education to me, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. But I learned a lot about railroading too, that you might say came prematurely. But to me, it's something that I've always enjoyed.
Harris, can I have your full name?
Alfred William Harris, and I was born here in Tacoma on March the 6th, 1923. And my family, quite a few of them, worked on the railroad. My dad was chief clerk in the yard when he retired. And I got my start working on the railroad in 1941. I graduated from high school then and went back to Minnesota on a trip for graduation present. When I returned, my dad He asked me what I expected to do for a job. He says they're hiring on the railroad and they're hiring down in the shipyard. Shipyards got started just a short time before that. And I figured the railroad would last a little longer than the shipyard would, so I said, well, I thought I'd try to get a job on the railroad. And so I was hired in the roundhouse and worked there for 6 months until I became 19 and was old enough to become a fireman then. And promoted to fireman in 1942 in March, and then 1952 became an engineer.
So by now this was for the Great Northern?
Northern Pacific.
Northern Pacific,
okay. Yeah, the Great Northern just has a small yard here in Tacoma and didn't do any hiring in Tacoma. They operated mainly out of Seattle. But Tacoma was a division point for the Northern Pacific, so a lot of trains originated here, and the hiring of men was done basically here. For here, this area is south to Portland.
When you went on the railroad, Mr. Hunt, did they have that requirement that you had to be 19 before you became a fireman?
Well, there used to be a lot of fudging about that. You know, some guys had changed their age. But you see, in 1919, I was only 18. But I, as I remember it, I gave the correct age. I don't remember. They were hard up for men, for one thing. And, of course, then in 1942, I went back, you see, because of my other employment. I had Friday and Saturday off. And kind of an odd thing, that two of the engineers that I used to know met me in the city hall one night. I was paying my light and water bill, and they wanted to know why I wasn't down there helping them with the train. Said, we can't get enough guys to move the engine to the train. And I said, well, I'm too old. He said, oh, no, you're not. So the upshot of it was that I did go down there, and I put in the next 27 months there, and I enjoyed it very much. And that's where some of the early practice I had came in very handy, because I knew things that I wouldn't have known otherwise, you know. And of course, I'll say this too, that the engines were much better kept in 1942 than they were in 1920 and 21, because in those days we were awful hard up for engines, and they were, a lot of them were old relics that had been pressed into service after being out of service for quite a number of years. Now, about what Al says about the Great Northern crews coming mostly from Seattle reminds me of one thing, that in those times, the Great Northern's crack train 1 and 2 was known as the Oriental Limited. And like Al says, most of their business was in Seattle, that is, in the terminal work. But through the pressure of the Tacoma Chamber of Commerce, the Great Northern finally acceded to extend the run of the Oriental Limited to Tacoma. And it used to arrive here, I believe, about 8:15 every morning, the whole train intact from Chicago. It would be right into the Union Depot, and then it would be taken to the Great Northern Yard by way of Reservation Junction and backing into their yard, and would be serviced all day. And the train would be taken out that night at 5:25 p.m. as number 2, the eastbound Oriental Limited. And at that time, you see, they were really giving Tacoma a bigger break than the Northern Pacific was. Now, in those days, they had a peculiar setup about the North Coast Limited. The North Coast Limited would come into East Auburn from the east as number 1. And the observation car, which was the very last car of the train, would be cut off by carmen. And the bulk of the train would be taken by the road engine on into Auburn and thence to Seattle, where it was serviced all day. But the stub connection from Tacoma that went to East Auburn to connect with that train for coach passengers would couple into this observation car and bring it to Tacoma for servicing. And that car was here all day being serviced while the rest of the North Coast Limited was in Seattle being serviced. Well, then that night at 9 o'clock, number two's connection, which I believe, if I remember right, the number 450, would leave here at 8:50 to connect with this 9 o'clock train out of Seattle. And the same process would be repeated in reverse. They always had the observation car in such a way that the Tacoma connection could back right down and put it in place on the train. Mm. So in those days, you see, we had all the observation cars for both the North Coast Limited and the Oriental Limited were serviced here in Tacoma. Well, it's been a long time since that's happened now. But I merely mentioned that to show that that was a kind of an odd arrangement in those times.
What year was that?
That was quite common. I'd say through the early 1920s.
I see.
And that was a standard procedure. They always kept a carman. He may have come from Auburn, I don't know. But I've seen it done that way many a time. And in the Pullman passengers, you see, in a Pullman passenger coming from, say, from St. Paul or Chicago, in number one, when they got to East Auburn, they would be moved into this observation car, see. Well, whereas the coach passengers would ride the coach car of the connecting train. But
they'd have to change
the Pullman passengers would simply move back into this observation car, which would be cut off, you see. And the stub would back right into that and bring it to Tacoma, see.
You know, talking about North Coast Limited, reminded me when I was a little kid, right at the end of the freight depot there on Puyallup Avenue, the Northern Pacific had a big signboard, billboard, and it had a picture of the North Coast Limited on it, and all used like to buy there at night because they had lights behind the rims of the wheels and the side rods and in the smoke of the picture, and they flickered so that the locomotive appeared to be moving and the smoke appeared to be curling back. Yeah. We were talking about that the other day down at work.
Yeah, that's
That sign disappeared, I guess, about World War II.
Yeah.
Somewhere
in those days, and certainly the coach or the passenger service was not sort of second fiddle in it, as it
No, it was very important. The passenger trains were given right away and the passengers were important, even though I don't suppose, as far as the railroad was concerned, it was a money-making deal, but it was a prestige
item
for them.
Largely instigated by the Chambers of Commerce, you see.
Yeah.
You see, going today, the trains were and still classed as first, second, and third class trains, see. Ordinarily, passenger trains are first class trains. In the fast freight, is usually a second-class train. Then in some branch lines, they had what they call mixed train, see, which is third-class or like a wave race, you see. But now, going back again to what Al said, the Red Northern, I'm put in mind of something else that I've wondered about, used to wonder. In addition to the crews that handled the Great Northern 1 and 2 to Tacoma, see, the same crew would take it out that night to Inter Bay, or they now call it Balmer Yard. But in addition to that, they had a fast freight. I don't believe it did any local work. But the caboose was always tied up along East D Street on the tail of the track there. They had a fast freight, usually not over, I'd say 15 to 20 cars, that would go out every night about from 6 to 7 p.m., just bound to Seattle, see. And then every morning, I think around 5 or 6 o'clock, this same run would bring fast freight into Tacoma from Inter Bay. So they, in those days, they really had two crews, the passenger crew and the freight crew, and then they, in addition to that, they had switch crews. I don't know how many of those there were. But as it is now, the Great Northern doesn't run any, that is before the merger, they haven't run anything like that for some years.
When I went to work on the Northern Pacific, I got started going out on the road. It was after that that I discovered that the Northern Pacific was the only railroad on here using coal. Great Northern and the Milwaukee and the Union Pacific were all oil-burning railroads. And it was kind of a shock to think that I was shoveling coal when those other firemen were just sitting there squirting oil into the firebox with a valve.
And it, so everybody, when you say that all the other railroads were using oil, then they were all diesel?
No, oil-burning steam locomotives.
Oh, I didn't know they had those.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was used more than coal was in later years. In fact, the Northern Pacific eventually converted all their steam engines to oil burners. In the last few years they had them, because the facilities for handling coal required quite a bit of upkeep and expense and people to handle it, whereas oil was fairly easy to handle. They could just pump it into a tank and then pump it into the engine tank. And you weren't dumping cinders, which had to be gotten rid of in some way, after they were dumped out of between the rails. There were a lot of headaches to coal. And, of course, the firemen had the most headaches because usually the coal wasn't very good quality. They used to call it Northern Pacific real estate because it was mostly mud. And trying to get good steaming out of some of that coal was just almost impossible. That was always the big fight, was to fire it so that it would burn properly. If you put a little too much in, it would tend to clinker. And when I went to work, we still had quite a few hand-fired engines. And knowing where to throw the coal, the shovel full of coal, and how to hit it on the opening in the... You stepped on a lever, and the butterfly door opened. And there was the hole that you threw the coal into the firebox. And if you struck the shovel just right on the edge of that, it would spray out. So that it would cover a large area lightly, and that gave you your best burning condition. The fire in a locomotive should be just white hot when it's burning properly. You shouldn't have any orange spots in it, because you got too much coal there then. And some engines, you had to know the different kinds. Some engines required quite a bit of coal in the back corners of the firebox. You could pile it up there, and that seemed to affect the draft of the fire in such a way that it would burn properly and steam properly. It was a kind of an art to knowing how to fire an engine. It wasn't always a big, strong guy that could do the best job, but some little fellas could do it just beautifully because they knew just how to get that coal in there to get the maximum amount of heat out of it.
Well, that really took an artist to do that. You see, the whole thing, when they talk about the butterfly door, you've got a pedal coming out here, see? And you stand here with one foot on the tank, and this on your apron here, you see, that it's going to be this. And you go into your coal this way, you see, at the same time this coming down. Then you come and you bounce that scoop on this black part of your firebox door, and like he says, the angle that you got it on there, and then the angle this way and the angle that way determines where that coal is going to go.
You use a little wrist movement. As it hit, you turn the shovel one way or the other to flip the coal.
I see in movies and the like, people just physically throwing, shovels.
It doesn't work that way. You wouldn't get very far.
With
the engines that had stokers put on them, which put the coal in by a mechanical means, usually a screw that brought the coal up, and then jets of steam would blow the coal off of a pot or through openings and spray the coal around in that manner. And you had a series of valves that control the amount of steam that came out of each jet so that you could spray those jets that put the coal in the very front part of the firebox. Had to be a little more pressure to get the coal up there. And it was quite a job getting those adjusted just exactly right. Because if too much began to pile up one spot, then clinkers were always a problem where the coal sits in a pile and melts rather than burns, and it turns into a, just like one big chunk of molten rock. And then you get too much of that in there, and the steam begins to drop back because the fire doesn't have the proper heat that it should. Then it was a job of sweating to get the clinker out. It had to be broken up with rods and pulled out by tongs out through the firebox door if it was big.
Quite hot.
Through the grates. And you could really sweat over a job like that. It was just hot physical labor doing it.
Those stokers were fine when they worked.
Right.
But on some locomotives that had what they called a duplex stoker. It was an upright cylinder, probably 12 or 14 inches in diameter, extending up from the floor. And there was also a screw proposition in that, working off the screw conveyor under the cap. But for some reason or other, in the limited experience that I had with them, I always had trouble on a rainy night. The right-hand stoker, on a rainy night, they used a fine powdery coal on those mostly. It would always jam, then you'd just have one side working, see. And if you were shoving something up a hill, you didn't have time to dig around in that, you know. You were too busy keeping your scoop, and you had to grab a scoop and start baling coal in there by hand. But for some reason, I remember that 4016 on the helper there, a couple of times I had that. And on a rainy night, that right-hand stoker would always jam.
Well, the reason they jammed was because of the rotation of the screw coming up. On the left-hand side, it naturally turned the coal into the opening that it went through to get into the firebox, whereas on the right-hand side, it was turning the wrong direction, and the coal had a tendency to mud up in a little restricted area, and it would pile up and then block the opening.
The vertical screw, you see, would work off of gear.
Yeah, and you just keep packing it tighter as blocked, you know. And it was a terrible, and like you said, rainy nights caused it.
I don't know, it was always a rainy night.
Made the mud a little stickier.
But on a dry day, for that fine powdery snow. But I always thought the other was a lot better rig.
The simplex stoker?
You know, you could put it anywhere you
operated
want.
Entirely within the firebox itself, with a pot right inside the firebox door.
Well, this may sound like a slight question, but when you did have an engine that you had to hand stoke, did they have some kind of mechanical device to keep shoving the coal from the tender forward so you could get at it?
We didn't have any here, but there were railroads that had a piston arrangement on the back of the coal compartment that you could operate and shove coal forward with that. It just moved a plate forward that shoved on the coal. But here we didn't do that. And usually in firing locomotive, you didn't stand there and constantly throw coal in. You did sometimes on real heavy pulls, like going up a very steep hill. But normally you would put a few scoops of coal in, and then you'd be a minute or at least a few seconds when you wouldn't do anything. And then you'd put in another spread of coal. Well, in between that time that you were firing, then you had to go back to the scoop, and after it began to get down where you couldn't reach it handily, you pull it forward so that it'd be ready for the next firing that you had to do. So he just kept the fireman real busy when he began to use up a lot of his coal. And sometimes, I never did it, but I have heard that they used to get hobos and allow them to ride the train if they pushed coal down for them. And they'll get a ride inside that way instead of having to hang on the outside of the car. And also sometimes you get brakemen that would help. If it was a real tough job of firing where you had to more or less stay right at it and the coal was getting a long ways back in the tank, it could get back as far as 10 feet back there eventually if you were beginning to empty the tank up. And some of the brakemen would push coal forward for you and keep it up where you could reach it with a shovel. So they were quite a bit of help in doing that. You'd get a cooperative one.
How much hold? Did a tender generally hold? Were they different sizes?
Yeah, there was quite a different size variations. I don't really remember what the tonnage was on it, because we never dealt in
on what?
On a steam engine. How many tons of coal would there be on one of those things?
Oh, they use up to 10 or 12 tons.
One of them. Yeah. That would, usually you'd stop and get coal on the way. You couldn't go clear to Portland normally on one load of coal. You'd go to Centralia, which is 54 miles south, and you'd have used quite a little bit of coal already. So you'd top it off there, and then what you had should take you right to Portland, because there was no place to get coal, any normal facility for getting coal until you got to Portland.
Well, and you remember, too, Al, at Lester, just east of the depot, there was a coal chute there where the engine would stop.
Right across, it straddled the main line.
And so while they were doing the station work there, the fireman put about 2 or 3 tons right on the front end of the tank, see? Mm-hmm. And it was right over the main line. This engine would stop. It'd sputter there.
It wouldn't have to cut off the engine from the train or anything. At Centralia, we'd have to leave the train and go to the roundhouse to get coal and then come back out. And it was a long, drawn-out process, because you'd clean the fire while you were there and get everything fresh, get filled up with water.
I always wondered, why is that track separated at Kent? There must have been a water tank or something there at some time. Do you remember?
I never heard.
It kind of bulges out like that.
They had a little passing track in between the two main lines.
Well, that might have been, but I don't remember it there. But they...
that's where we used to pick up... on 680 going south, that job that came down from Sumas to Auburn, the one they call 6 bits.
675 and 6, yeah.
Yeah, they used to set out the Portland stuff on this little track in between us.
Oh, that was there.
And they would go down against the current of traffic and do that, and that way we could just back in and pick it up. Oh. Or if they were ahead of us, of course, you'd go the right way.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's sure torn up now, though, isn't it?
I haven't been over there for a long time.
Works out of wooden bill now, I guess. Branches down that way. Yeah. That's so different the way it used to be. Guys like Al and I, we can look back on these and see how it is now and remember how things used to be before the merger, and all these... They used to run so many more trains.
Yeah, Tacoma was a much more important rail center. So much stuff originated here. Now it's just for trains passing through, except for the only thing originating here now is about 3 little locals. Of course, Milwaukee, they still originate all of their runs out.
See, in those days, the Northern Pacific and the Great Northern both ran 3 passenger trains a day in each direction, from Seattle and Tacoma to Portland. And the Northern Pacific, in addition to that, ran 3 passenger trains a day in each direction from Tacoma to Grays Harbor. Now there's 9 trains right there, you see. Then in addition, they had one train, 591, 592. Those days ran 2 trains a day in each direction from Portland to Tacoma and Seattle. So that much business, you can see, really kept the tracks pretty busy. And in addition to that, of course, there was all the connection business to Auburn and Seattle, and there was one local train. Those were the milk train mostly. Left Seattle at 6:45 every morning and came to Tacoma and turned around and left here at 10:10 a.m. Went back to Seattle. That's all they did that day. the crew on that one. That was part of the old vaudeville run. See, it was six crews, and it took you 5 days to get around because there were so many chores for these fellows to do. The milk train was one of them. Then you see, there were some trains that went from Tacoma to Auburn twice a day. And there was another that went only once a day. And there was another that tied up. It connected with 318, the Spokane train. The crew that caught that would go to East Auburn and transfer their passengers to 318 out of Seattle. Then they'd turn the engine, bank the fire, and get a plank, and sleep the rest of the night till 5:30, when 317 would arrive from Spokane. Then they would bring the outfit back to Tacoma. There was one night in this six if they had to sleep on a pack, on a plank, or else go back in the coaches. So that Bonneville was quite a thing in those days. It took care of all the replacement engines, you see, from Great Harbor trains that changed engines in Tacoma. And then, of course, it took care of all the connecting runs to Auburn and Seattle. In addition to that, the Buckley Line was a pretty busy place in those days, too, in the early 20s. We had two trains a day out of Tacoma, 596 and 598. One went in the morning to Kanaska, what the Buckley Line to Ording and South Prairie, and Cascade Junction, Buckley, Enumclaw, and Beasley, Palmer Junction, and then back down to Kanaska, and then go on to Carriston, up to Hemlock and Carriston, which were over east of Kanaska. Then that train usually came right back, made a round trip during the forenoon. But the evening train stayed overnight at Kanaska and came back the next morning. So that was the Union Depot in those days was really a very busy place. Well, now it's only probably not over 4 or 5 trains a day now, but in those days there were dozens of them.
Were they mostly
Amtrak is all they got there now.
And these were all passenger or
they were all
company?
Passenger trains.
Okay.
That's amazing.
They were small trains, you know, they didn't have many cars on them because it was kind of like a commuter setup, only there wasn't any way for these little outlying towns, for the people there to get to Tacoma or to get to Seattle and that. So that was the way people really traveled about, you know.
I guess, no buses.
No buses. No some buses. Places didn't even have roads to them. You know?
The roads were very poor. Yeah. And in those days, too, little outlying places like South Prairie, Harrison, Hemlock, these, they had either small sheet mills or planer mills or shingle mills or small mines, see, coal mines mostly. And those industries are practically, well, along with Ravensdale and the Black Diamond, they're practically extinct now.
Yeah.
But in those days, they were going strong. And like Al says, there was no bus service in that day, and people that lived in those communities, the only way they could get to town was to use these trains.
And a lot of the loggers would come to town on their weekends.
Yeah.
They get especially on payday, and it'd be a pretty rough crowd going back when they had finished their time in the city.
I didn't realize so much of the traffic must.
Yeah, it was. I collect old postcards, and you'd be surprised how many people write and say they'd be in on the train this day, and they were only lived, say, at Everett and were coming into Tacoma, but they'd come by train or by boat. A lot of people travel the Sound, you know, on boats. Seattle to Tacoma, there were a lot of them do that. But the trains handled an awful lot of people those days.
Oh, it was the way to go in those days.
Right.
It wasn't
too awfully expensive for people, you know, and I can remember even when I was firing, we had one train, 422 and 3, that ran from Seattle to Grays Harbor, and we'd have people come out and wave a handkerchief, and we'd know we were supposed to stop and pick them up, and it wasn't a regular stop, except that we would look for them in that particular area, you know. Like one trip we were going down, and the conductor came up, and there's a place called Mima that lies between Little Rock and Gate. All it is just a sign on a post, and we never picked up anybody there very often. Once in a while, there'd be a lady at the road crossing there, and we'd pick her up. But this one day, they said to stop about a half mile back from there, and it was two old ladies wanting to get off. We couldn't imagine what they were getting off there for, but come to find out, there was a cemetery just over in a field a little ways, and we'd seen these trees in this little plot, but we didn't realize that it was a cemetery, you know. So we just dropped them off, and they said they'd be there that evening when we came back, and sure enough, we watched, and there they were, and we stopped and picked them up.
Well, another example, too, of how the trains were patronized in those days. You'd ride any of these trains going from Seattle and Tacoma to Portland. When they get to Centralia, you'd be surprised at the number of people on the platform. You see a lot of people on the train would get off, and the gate branch trains were always backed in at the north end of the Centralia depot on a stub track, and at the south end was a stub train that went to South Bend in that way. Now these trains on the north end, they only went from Centralia to Gate, where they connected with the train Al was talking about that came from Seattle to Tacoma, you see, Gate and Junction. And that train shuttled back and forth all day long, connecting with the third Grace Harbor trains and the Seattle, Tacoma, Portland trains at Centralia. That was quite
a busy. It was a way of getting it to Olympia, too.
Yeah.
You could go from Centralia.
Centralia was a beehive in those days. That's why there's all paved, so such a big area there around the depot. They used to back the trains right in. You know. Now there's nobody there.
No.
It's amazing. I'm very amazed at that much.
Everybody drives.
Those days, it was unusual to find anybody who had ridden a train.
Yeah.
I mean, train travel was just accepted by everybody, you know. It was the quick way of getting someplace. Nobody thought of driving back to the Midwest or anything.
The roads were
on a train and going.
There were no freeways in those days.
Even their best highways were pretty rugged.
It used to be an ordeal to drive from Tacoma to Portland on the so-called Pacific Highway. That is a lot easier to sit on a nice, comfortable train, look out the window.
You know, and riding the train, I remember when we would go, we made several trips over to Montana or back to Minnesota. You always carried lunch with you. That lunch would last maybe two or three days. You'd keep digging into it. First day you'd have fried chicken and stuff like maybe some potato salad and that. You didn't have any refrigeration, so you had to eat it the first day. I was always kind of embarrassed. You know, you'd sit there in the Pullman section, or sometimes we wouldn't even have a Pullman, sit up all the way. And we'd get our lunch, mother would get the lunch out for us, you know, and people would sit and look, see what you had to eat. And the big event was when they finally ran out of lunch and got to go to the diner to eat.
I've been there, Al. I know what you're talking about.
I still love to get in the diner and eat. You know, sit there and watch the world traveling by outside your window and have a nice meal.
That was a thrill in those times.
It still is. Let me tell you, for us that don't ride it very often.
I can remember, too, we'd come into a station and they'd say 20 minutes stop. And my dad would jump off and he'd head for the restaurant, and all the other passengers, it seemed like, would all get there at the same time, and they'd be serving everybody at once, sandwiches and coffee and everything, and everybody'd grab whatever they could and then rush back to the train and bring their food with them, of course, you know, and hope that they wouldn't pull out before you got your order.
There's one facet of railroading that's been dropped these many years. I sure wish they'd put back. When I was in my early teens, the North Pacific, during the summer months, about every Sunday, or I should say maybe 2 months, would run excursion trains, usually two, as sections, every Sunday from Tacoma to either Pacific Beach or Moclips on the ocean shore.
That was really popular places.
Yeah. And both places in those days had the big hotels for the more affluent passengers. They'd go and get their liquor and meals, one thing or another. But for the most part, most passengers just wanted to sit on the beach, you know, or dig clams or something. But that was such a nice thing and such an adventure for a teenage boy to ride on those trains. They came right along here, by the way, to South Tacoma. There wasn't any Point Defiance line in those days. And I remember riding up the hill here with a switch engine shoving behind the thing, you know, down the, go down the, what we call the Prairie Line now, down to Roy and Yelm, that way, to Centralia. And then they'd turn off there on this gate line and go right straight on down to Aberdeen, Hopium, and up to Moclips. And they usually stay there around 7 or 7.30 in the evening. It'd be still daylight. And they'd give you a warning, half hour before they're going to leave. All day coaches, maybe 15 or 16 of them in one train. There'd be a couple of trains there.
Always
now,
fun.
I forget.
Did they double head those two engines on them? Did they put double headers on that many?
No, it was two trains.
I see.
Two trains, two separate sections. As I remember, the fare was only $2.50 or $3, something like that.
They were very popular, always
yeah.
With the trains?
And the trains were always jammed full. Now, why don't they do something like that now? You know?
Well, not enough money in it anymore.
I suppose, but they... it was such a gay, happy crowd on there, too. Of course, there was always some of them that were full of beer, you know.
Sure.
Get a little bit obnoxious, but for my part, I always thought it was wonderful, you know. And usually, an aunt or an uncle or my folks would go, and it was a wonderful experience to me. I always enjoyed the train riding of it more than the ocean itself.
Sure.
That interested me, and they'd have to turn the engine and one thing or another, you know. And I think now they ought to revive that, because a lot of people would like to go on a outing, and hundreds of them I know would prefer the trains of battling traffic on the highways, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The freeways. Well, you were never interested in the railroad back in Baltimore, though.
Never was around it. Only time we
that
took
was
it.
On the Pennsylvania corridor down through there.
Yeah, we never lived through that area much. We our biggest interest was the old canals they still have from the B&O.
Yeah, that's right. That was canal. See, Herman, when was this depot occupied? Was that a long time ago?
The South Tacoma?
No, the main depot downtown.
Oh, I think it was 1914.
Yeah. Oh, it was then. I didn't know if it was the turn of the century or if it was
there. Yeah, I think it was about 1914, along there. I don't just remember.
It was just about.
But I do remember when it was built, it was regarded as one of the masterpieces of the depot architecture, you know.
You know, they had the architect's picture of that depot over at Steve's K90s here. I just wonder if that was sold when they sold a lot of the artifacts. It was a beautiful tinted picture, you know, how architects draw it up to show you what it's going to look like. It's really big size picture. But I haven't been over there for a long time. I still have it. Well, do you remember when the depot was the old wooden one then,
No, I was too young.
I guess it was down on the lower
original,
level.
The original depot was down there pretty close to where the old Flyer Dock was, you know, down by...
Oh, way down there, yeah. But they had one depot that was on Pacific Avenue.
Yeah.
That I guess was what was later the Carmen's building there, right by the coach tracks. That's what I was told anyway. Yeah, one of the things I always remember about the depot was at Christmas time, they'd have a great huge Christmas tree inside. It was that big high dome where they could put just a huge tree in there. And they really, really had some beautiful trees set up in that.
I think there's something right in there.
Is that Mr. Tacoma?
Yeah, I'm Mr. Tacoma. Alan Herman's loaned me the first volume. I'm slowly working my way through it.
Slow.
It's really interesting, though.
Yeah.
The fellow that wrote it had a nice style of writing. It makes it...
Yeah, he's a good writer, wasn't he?
It is dull reading. It makes a real story out of it.
Good newspaper. He was an editor of one of the
local. Oh, was he? I didn't know that.
I think I'll
have a picture of it.
Oh, yeah. Pretty fancy.
I was thinking there was a depot picture there, but I don't find it right offhand. What a good book, Al.
Yeah, they sure are. Oregon and Washington Railroad. I remember my dad always referred to the UP as the O&W.
Yeah, O&W, yeah.
Everybody calls it, they didn't call it Union City, they call it O&W, which was Oregon and Washington Railway Navigation Company.
They used to have the funniest ideas, though.
UP bought them out.
Yeah, they did. They, let's see, they had, we call the Amtrak calls their number 11 now, the southbound job.
Yeah.
But the original number 11 was an SP job, and it was run here by the Union Pacific. And that was their train number 11.
Uh-huh.
But the funny part of it was, is I remember it went through here about 11:30 in the morning. This was years ago. But the funny part of it was that about 15 minutes ahead of it, they ran their other passenger train, first class, right? I think it was about 11 o'clock. And I always wondered, why did they put those two trains so close together?
Yeah,
the other was going to go in the
Portland. Spread them out.
One was known as 361, and the other was known as 11. And I used to wonder, they didn't come back at the same time. They were only 15 or 20 minutes apart, 361 and this number 11, which was known as the Shasta Limited. It ran in conjunction with the Southern Pacific.
So both of you worked as firemen on a lot of the passenger trains.
Yeah, I used to fire the different NP trains that ran from Seattle to Portland, both the night train, which was 401 and 2, and the day train. Their best train was 407 and 8, which ran during the middle of the day and had the biggest train. And then they also had a another train that was kind of a mail train. What, do you remember the number of that one, Port?
Well, that was the one that originated back east, wasn't it? That came around by Portland. It was when the government took over the railroads, Mikado.
Oh, no, I mean when I was firing on it.
Oh. No, there
was
401
and
2, 407 and 8, and 413 and 414. But,
That must have been what it was, 13 and 14. I
413.
I'd have to look it up again.
Was known as the Evergreen Limited. And, the one I was talking about, that was in World War I, by golly, come to think, when Mikado took over the railroads. I was working in the roundhouse. I just started there, see. This train was about 20 baggage cars. And it started, I don't know, New York or Chicago, and it made a circuitous tour. The reason was they took the baggage cars and mail cars off all first-class trains. See, that was an economy move that Mikado made. And they, instead of letting them people check their baggage on those trains, the baggage was all herded onto this train. I forget what they did call it. It had a name. Usually from 18, 20, or 25 cars, baggage cars and mail cars and storage cars and one thing or another. And it started somewhere, I believe in Chicago. And it's been part of the way over the UP, part of the way over the Great Northern. And it made a circuitous route, see. And anyway, we got it from Portland. It came up from Portland here in the early morning hours. I think it was between 4 and 5 o'clock. It was right ahead of what that UP used to run later, you know, the 564, I think they called it. But that was quite a sight, and here's something else I remember about it. That sometimes there'd be Tacoma stuff, like stock for Roach Brothers, People Store, and McCormick's, and Sears and stuff, wouldn't be, they wouldn't break the train up, but they'd spot the cars in Union Depot, and maybe the tail end would be down there by the 15th Street Bridge, see? Then they'd have to move the train up so that they get in some other Tacoma stuff that was in a car way back there. See? Some guy had a waybill that showed where all this stuff was in the train. See? Mm-hmm. And that was a government train. That was, it had a nickname, but so long ago, I can't remember what they called it. And for several months, that ran every night. I don't remember when it went east, but I remember that westbound train, and it would get in the way of everybody because it was so long. And nothing but baggage cars, all of that, mail and baggage. And it wasn't especially fast either. It was a darn slow train. That was so the passenger trains didn't have to carry baggage cars or mail cars.
Speed it up a bit.
Yeah. Because in those days, I think that even preceded the Great Northern's mail train, that 27 and 28 that they ran later. But, that was quite a deal, too. I guess they call that they're number four now, don't they? Number three and four.
I couldn't say for sure.
It's on the time card going west, but not east.
Oh, yeah. Just does run one direction.
They, I don't think they send that. Show that on the card. Got enough light there?
Oh, yeah.
I'm forgetting that. Gosh, I'd pretty near forgotten that. I forget what they called that train. There was always about 18 or 20 baggage and mail cars in the thing. They don't even show it in that one.
Something that I've never seen much information on, and I've often wondered about it, is the old Tacoma Eastern Railroad.
Oh. Well, there's a picture in there of the race to the mountain between the automobile and the train.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. No, it shows both three and four here. Now, that's that mail train. I didn't think they did for a while.
Oh, Tacoma.
Is that the one that went up to
Ashford?
Yeah. That was quite a railroad once on a time.
That's the one Milwaukee bought it and now uses that to get up through the gulch to go south. But at one time it was quite a little railroad, I guess. Had their own depot down there someplace.
Somewhere, I always wondered why
near Puyallup Avenue, I guess they had the depot.
Well, it wasn't Puyallup Avenue. It was up there. I remember how scared I was. My dad, I was only just a very small punk. And my dad went with some club up there, and we were over at the Old Tacoma Eastern Depot, which was down there under the, about what's 25th and E now, I guess it would be. And my dad got up on the running board of this steam engine, and it had outside the pump exhaust, one thing or another, and I was scared to death looking at my dad up there on this thing before the train left, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And I was hanging on to my mother, and I was scared that my dad would get burned or something up there on this engine, you know. There's a picture in there.
Yeah, I hear this here.
Yeah.
This is after the Milwaukee had taken over, because it had the Milwaukee locomotive on it. Getting ready for that. It was supposed to be a very scenic route to take to go to the mountain.
Boy, that's bum track and stuff. Something like going to the Griffin Wheel Works.
Yeah. Let a piece of railroad.
When you went to work, Mr. Hunt, for the railroad, you said you were in the roundhouse. And could you describe to me what you used to do in the roundhouse?
Oh, a lot of things. The roundhouse was where they made light repairs on an engine, and they tested the wheel flanges, they washed the boilers, they set pops. You know, the emergency, a pop is an emergency valve on a locomotive that got too much steam so the boiler wouldn't burst. Well, she'd pop, see? But they have to be set. There's an adjustment screw on your pop dome, it was known as, and a mechanic, machinist, had to get up there with a big heavy wrench, and somebody else would stay in the cab and keep a good lively fire and the blower going so that your steam, you see, the engine's supposed to pop at 200 pounds, most of them, and when it pops up here to 200 pounds, but it's supposed to make a big explosion and see, you know, let the steam escape. And then that take off about 3 or 4 pounds. And then the trick was to keep the blower going and keep your fire fanning up, you know, like you had a fan on that, you know, until she'd get up again. Well, meantime, it supposedly didn't go off at 200. It went off at, say, 202. Well, then the guy up there has to take his wrench, and he's got cotton in his ears, one thing or another, and pull that thing down and hope that he's got it 200 instead of 202. Then he'd have to kind of rear back like this. You know, the steam is right here, the big valve's about so gross, you saw. And then the man in the cab would fan his fire again, and just bang again. That's called setting the pots. That's one thing they did in the roundhouse. Another thing, they would change brake shoes, and they would adjust coupler height, and they would wash boilers, and they'd give hydro tests, and they'd check wheel flanges, and any engineer bringing in a steam engineer always fills out a work report. And he would show maybe the sanders don't work correctly, or the right sander is jammed or something, or maybe the dynamo.